How did we get from Richard Nixon to Ronald Reagan, and what can the period between 1973 and 1976 tell us about our politics today? Rick Perlstein joins us to talk about the third volume in his monumental history of conservatism, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan.
I'm very nostalgic for people's willingness to really look hard at what was wrong with America. I think we could use a heck of a lot of that sort of critical temper now.
How did a child prodigy in Germany grow up to become the defining composer of the modern age? Jan Swofford will join us to talk about his new biography, Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph.
Todd Berlioz went to hear it for the first time, and he said after he came out, he was so upset and excited that when he tried to put his hat on, he couldn't find his head.
Is your office mate plotting a novel out of overheard snippets of conversation? My colleague at the Book Review, Amy Rowland, will tell us about just how she came to write her new novel, The Transcriptionist. Alexander Alter will join me with notes from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Rick Perlstein joins me now. He is the author of The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, reviewed on the cover this week by Frank Rich. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Pam. Great to be here.
Let's start with the title of the book, because it doesn't exactly mean what you might think it means. Where did you get the title?
Well, I'm interested to know what you think it means. The title comes from, curiously enough, something that Nikita Khrushchev, of all people, said to Richard Nixon when Nixon was in Moscow for the famous kitchen debate. Nikita gave him political advice. He said, if the people think that there's a imaginary river out there, don't tell them there isn't a river. Build them an imaginary bridge. And I took poetic license. I don't know about the translation of the Russian, but I just kind of misread it, I think, at first as invisible and just kind of stuck with that.
And why did you choose that as the title of this particular book?
It kind of refers, the most neutral description would be that it refers to the portion of politics and statecraft, which is about sort of storytelling and imagery and myth-making. I guess you could kind of give it a negative coloration and use a word that was once described in the pages of the New York Times by Anthony Lucas as an eight-letter barnyard epithet. Nonsense. Kind of politicians pulling the wool over people's eyes. But I'll leave that to the reader to decide their own interpretation. The book basically, fundamentally, this big, big book with so many threads in it, is fundamentally a story about how in the 1970s, following Watergate, following Vietnam, at the beginning of the energy crisis, the United States, its political culture, kind of began this kind of salutary realism that the citizens, the elites, the media were really beginning to look hard at the myths that had kind of sustained America's sense of moral superiority. And kind of the things that almost seem to kind of place it kind of beyond the rules of kind of normal politics and normal international relations. And I think that was a really good thing. We were beginning to look at our institutions in a very mature and realistic way. The story the book tells is how that kind of began to fall apart and how Americans abandoned that difficult work and just kind of learn to stop worrying and sort of become more jingoistic, more unquestioning about America's prospects. And I put Ronald Reagan at the center of that.
You write that the belief that America could do no wrong, or that if America did it, it was by definition not wrong.
Right. And, you know, somewhere along the way, I quote, I think in the first instance, Reagan is kind of publicly on the record citing Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon that America shall be a shining city on a hill.
Of course.
And I point out, actually derived from the argument of a friend of mine, the writer and lawyer Tom Gagin, that John Edwards did not mean America is, you know, kind of touched by the grace of God and should be beyond criticism. He meant, since the eyes of the world are upon us, that was the other part of the quote, that everyone was looking at us, that we had to hold ourselves to a kind of sterner moral standard than other countries, which is not what Reagan meant.
Let's step back, because this is, as you said, a very big book, but it concerns the period between 1973 and 76 and is the third in what I believe is going to be a four-volume history?
Yes, and I think I just got so fascinated with telling the story of a Watergate and how Americans experienced it that this book kind of became a self-contained thing that ends with the 1976 Republican nomination fight. And then there'll be another one that goes to Reagan's victory in 1980.
So let's talk about the first two books and what you covered there, mm-hmm. And what the overarching idea is with these four volumes. The first book was Before the Storm. What period did that look at?
That covered 1958 to 1964 and kind of culminates in the nomination of Barry Goldwater, the first kind of genuinely right-wing conservative Republican nominee.
And the idea behind all the books is looking at the rise of American conservatism?
That's one of the kind of spines of the series. Mm-hmm. Another is looking at how American political culture deals with conflict and difference within kind of the American political family.
In the second book was Nixon Land. And what was the period that you looked at?
That starts in 1965. Mm-hmm. Kind of the initial incident that sets the story moving is the Watts riots in August of that year. And it goes to Richard Nixon's landslide 1972 victory.
And the period for this, 1973 to 1976, again, it seems like such an odd choice for a book that's about the rise of Reagan, because, of course, it ends with Ford's victory, at least at the polls.
Right. Another important thing to understand is, yes, Ford won his party's nomination in 1976 after, of course, becoming an accidental president after Nixon resigned, but that he almost lost, which was an amazing thing in itself. The fact that Ronald Reagan almost became the nominee in 1976, Ford would have been the first incumbent president to have been denied his party's nomination since Chester Arthur. Not only did Reagan come very, very close, the whole time as he's kind of sneaking up on Gerald Ford, the kind of mainstream media was completely ignoring the possibility that he might do so. So some very important and exciting and interesting shifts are happening in American politics kind of subterraneously, kind of just beneath the surface. So if we don't think that 1973 to 1976 is a very big deal in kind of American political history, that's because, in a sense, the story hasn't been told yet.
You write about the development of Reagan conservatism as something that the establishment was unaware of, that took them by surprise. And this seems to be a recurring theme in your books, and obviously one that reverberates today with the Tea Party. Were you thinking about those parallels while you were writing?
You know, I do. A lot of academic historians kind of caution against presentism, what they call presentism, you know, telling history in light of the present. A, I think it's impossible, but B, I don't think it's desirable. I mean, I think all history is the history of the present. That's why we're interested in it. I mean, you don't want to kind of project the present onto the past. You want to kind of allow the reader to kind of savor its difference. You know, sometimes it's radical difference. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the punditry, kind of this class of people who kind of take it upon themselves to kind of explain America to itself, I'm very fascinated in their patterns of thought and the fact that they kind of repeat the same mistakes over and over and over. So I believe that has to be analyzed. And one of those patterns is, you know, basically every 2 years they declare a conservative populism to be dead. There's a really amazing quote I get from a Joseph Kraft column. He was kind of, if I may be forgiven, the Thomas Friedman of his day the David Broder of his day, I think would be more accurate, perhaps. And he said in 1974, well, this primary in California that they just had proves that conservative populism is now a dead letter in American politics. You know, people said the same thing when Jimmy Carter was elected. People said the same thing in 1982 when the Democrats gained against Reaganism in the midterm election. They said the same thing after Clinton was elected. They said the same thing when Clinton was reelected. They said the same thing when Barack Obama was elected and reelected. And they said the same thing only a few months ago when it was declared that kind of the Republican establishment had kind of regained their dominance in the party against the Tea Party. And then, you know, every time they say this, they're kind of ritually and serially embarrassed by events.
So you have sort of two simultaneous narratives going on here. One, looking at this period between 1973 and 1976, mm-hmm. and then also going back earlier to talk about Reagan's life. How did you deal with those two threads at the same time?
That's very important to kind of my historical method. I'm not a biographer. You know, I put people at the center, you know, big figures at the center of my books, but the kind of the figure that I'm really trying to understand is the electorate, the voters. A very prominent political scientist who just passed away this year named James McGregor Byrne wrote a book called Leadership, and he really kind of described how I understand my project of using biography to explain history, which is that kind of a transformative or a leader or one that kind of really sort of seems to resonate with a particular historical movement is someone whose own kind of private kind of psychological makeup ends up notching with the longings of a broader public. So it's very important to understand that psychological makeup and where it comes from. You know, in the case of Richard Nixon, it was his, you know, sense that he'd always been humiliated by people who considered themselves kind of his cultural superiors. So he rode that resentment and kind of spoke of it in his political life. You know, and you can trace it to his childhood. But you can also find the same rhetoric in, say, his silent majority speech, in which he kind of claims these liberals who think that they're more moral than you and they're better than you. Well, it turns out you're moral than them, more moral than them and better than them. And in Reagan's case, it really was this kind of lonely, forlorn kid who had this kind of terrible, chaotic childhood, but kind of figuring out a way to find the bright side of everything. And that really notched with America's mood in the 1970s. Everything was all chaotic. Someone who could kind of reduce that complexity and chaos to blithe optimism was very healing, was very soothing, was very desirable.
Everyone likes to, you know, dig into the psychology of Nixon. But Reagan, it seems, has, for the most part, kind of baffled people. People find it very hard to understand him and his motivations and who he really was, you know, beneath this surface. Did you feel like you got at him and sort of understood him?
Yeah, I you know, humbly, I mean, that's up to the reader to decide. I think I understand him to my satisfaction. You can't really understand Reagan without understanding kind of the family dynamics and children of alcoholism. You can't really understand him without sort of thinking about how some people are so kind of skilled and gifted in kind of developing an armor around their inner conflict that the armor almost becomes the inner self. His ability to kind of tell a heroic story in whatever situation he found himself in was not kind of something that covered up something. It became kind of the core sense of his being.
You talk about this being a history told through biographies, but there's also a lot of great cultural anecdotes and stories that you tell in the book about this period, 1973 to 76. What stories did you choose? I mean, Hank Aaron was one, Saturday Night Live. How did you decide what to include?
The idea behind this method is people don't consume, except unless they're true political junkies, but even those don't. They don't consume kind of culture and popular culture and politics in isolation from each other. There really is kind of a zeitgeist, and often kind of culture is the leading indicator. It's kind of where our dream life is kind of lived. So, you know, I try and find examples that seem to kind of be sort of rich scenes of the nation's inner life. Ronald Reagan, when he was a baseball announcer in the 1930s, linked that to this very suffusing sense of nostalgia that pervaded the culture in the 1970s. So you had things like American Graffiti becoming a big hit movie, which, you know, said, where were you in 1962? You had things like The Exorcist, which kind of showed sort of the chaos of our children kind of being possessed by demons. And then in the end, when she's kind of exorcised, the last scene is the family literally looking like they're stepping out of 1962. So this longing to go back to a more innocent time was everywhere in popular culture. And it took a little lag time for politicians to be able to kind of express that too.
I don't think anyone looks back at this particular era with nostalgia. I mean, it's kind of a grim period,
yeah,
culturally and politically. Did you find something to love about it?
Yeah, I'm very nostalgic for the high level of citizen engagement. I mean, the fact that the Watergate hearings, both the Senate hearings in 1973 and the House impeachment hearings in 1974 were incredibly complex. To follow them, you had to master a great level of detail, and you really had to get inside the guts of how the American constitutional system worked. And yet they got the highest ratings of any news shows ever. I'm very nostalgic for people's willingness to really look hard at what was wrong with America. Popular culture, like, say, the show MASH, was literally inverting the kind of formula of kind of the traditional kind of John Wayne macho war story and made the people who were skeptical of war into the heroes. I think we could use a heck of a lot of that sort of critical temper now. The fact that this political culture has become dominant, you know, the fact that someone like Barack Obama sort of almost ritually has to say America is the greatest country that ever walked the face of the earth in order to kind of, that's kind of the ticket for admission to be taken seriously politically, that's what keeps us from kind of tackling our truly big structural problems. Things like calling the banking system to account for the collapse of the economy. I mean, if you can't really kind of dig into what might be wrong with America, how can we possibly fix America and make it right again?
Well, that seems like a good note to end on and await the next installment, both of your history and of what it will tell us about where we are maybe 4 or 5 years from now. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
That was Rick Perlstein, author of The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, reviewed this week on the cover by Frank Rich. Alexandra Alter joins me now with notes from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi.
So you have breaking news here about a new book.
I do. So Oscar Iuelos was working on a book for 12 years leading up to his death that very few people knew about. And his publisher, Grand Central Publishing, said this week that they are going to release this posthumous novel next fall. So it'll be sort of a coda to his career, which was cut short. He died at just age 62 with, you know, several more novels in the works.
And he died when?
He died last fall. He had a heart attack. It was quite sudden. And, you know, at that point, he'd published 9 works over 30 years, but he was a slow writer. He was very improvisational. He did a lot of research. So people did feel that his career was cut short suddenly.
And he was the first Latino writer to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction.
That's right. When he won for the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love, he was the first Latino writer to win the prize.
What year was that?
That was 1989, I believe.
And had he completed this book before his death?
He had. He had fully completed it, even though it, you know, he tried several different approaches over the decade plus that he was working on it. He was ready to send it out. His wife and literary agent told me the Monday, he died 2 days before they were going to send the manuscript out. And then after that, his wife was just too distraught to sort of deal with the publication process. And a few months later, she decided, you know what, he was ready for this to go out to the world. I think it's time to seek out a publisher.
Oh, did he not have an editor at a publisher that he worked with on his previous novels that he wanted to go back to?
You know, he had jumped around quite a bit from different publishers. And so the people that they sent it to, there were just a handful of editors that saw the manuscript, were people that he had worked with previously for the most part.
And so who is the editor and publisher for this?
Gretchen Young at Grand Central Publishing is editing it, and she's quite daunted by the task. It's 860-some pages, and that's obviously not commercially viable. So she's planning to cut about 200 pages at least, maybe 300, and is considering maybe preserving some of those outtakes digitally so that, you know, given that this is most likely his final book, you know, for hardcore fans who want to see every last word he wrote, they might try to do digital outtakes.
Had she worked with him before?
She had. She worked with him on a previous book at another publisher.
And what's the new book about? Because it's based in reality, right?
Yes. It's actually quite a departure for him, which I think is another thing that makes this sort of an interesting story, because it sort of shows some range that people maybe hadn't seen. He's, you know, best known for kind of chronicling the lives of immigrants and the immigrant experience and assimilation. And this book is about Mark Twain and the 19th century explorer Henry Morton Stanley, who apparently had this long-running 37-year friendship. And apparently Oscar Iuelos was fascinated by them and had been following both of their careers, studying them since he was in his 20s.
Is there written correspondence between the two of them?
There is written correspondence, and he had amassed, I think, 6 boxes worth of historical documentation. And this novel, he struggled with how to tell it. He ended up doing something sort of using an omniscient narrator, but also using diary entries from the central characters. And there's also Stanley's wife, Dorothy Tennant, who was this bohemian portrait artist. And I believe that the novel sort of constructs maybe a love triangle of sorts. Yeah.
When can readers see this?
This is scheduled for next fall of 2015. There's the editing process, of course, and they also have this previously unpublished short story that sounds quite interesting that features John Lennon, actually. So they're going to release that probably as an e-short in anticipation of the novel next fall.
It's interesting how there are electronic plans in the works with the digital outtakes and an e-short, that's kind of part of the process at this early stage.
It's interesting. And I think, you know, they're trying to take advantage of having these works from him and sort of having more to show to his fans. But again, when you have something for a short story, you know, you can't release a single short story. So the digital format is actually, I think, useful in this context.
All right. Well, a very far ahead glimpse into fall 2015. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Jan Swafford joins me now. He is the author of Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph, reviewed this week in the Book Review by Jeremy Denk. Hi, Jan. Welcome.
Hello, Pamela.
So you have written biographies before of Ives and of Brahms and spent a decade working on this biography of Beethoven. Why Beethoven?
Well, I felt that he's been kind of owned by academic writers for a good long time, and most of those books, some of which are perfectly fine, are still more ideas about Beethoven than Beethoven himself. And I felt it had been a long time since a good general reader book that concentrated on him as a person, as well as the music, really hadn't been done in a long time. And since he's one of my favorite composers, like most people, he was kind of an obvious choice for that reason, but I didn't expect it to take more than 10 years.
He moved to Vienna in 1792 intending to study with Mozart, but ended up studying with Haydn. How did that happen? Do we know why he didn't end up studying with Mozart?
Well, that's two different trips. He went to Vienna first to at least meet Mozart and play for him when he was 16, and he only stayed 2 weeks because his mother was dying, and he was called back. Then he went back to Vienna permanently when he was 22, and that's when he studied with Haydn briefly, but I think very importantly.
What was so important about that period?
Well, you can just see it in his music. He as a teenager, he actually spent more time practicing piano and playing than he did composing. And the music he wrote as a teenager was brilliant and promising, but you see when after he had been around Haydn a little bit, among other things, for example, his teenage music, he had no sense of proportion. He might write a 5-page introduction to an aria. And after his contact with Haydn, he had a tremendous sense of proportion and balance and form. And I think a lot of that came from Haydn because that's what he was so good at.
How did he transition from becoming primarily a pianist and a performer to becoming a composer?
He started going deaf. The reality is he was one of the greatest pianists of his time, and he always looked at himself as a composer-pianist. That's what he wanted to be, and he loved playing in public, even though he preferred to improvise rather than play his written music. And at around 1802, he realized he was going to go deaf, and that was going to ruin his career as a pianist, and I think that's one of the things that depressed him. It was also more than half his income playing piano.
I mean, it wasn't just deafness. What else was going on, and what caused the deafness?
We don't know what caused the deafness, though one theory is about a typhus. He had some kind of chronic interior disease that just totally messed up his gut. He was in pain a lot, and you know, huge episodes of intestinal distress were just a regular part of his entire life. And on top of that, he had abscesses, illnesses of all kinds, serious eye problems that could have blinded him in later years. He wasn't totally deaf ever, stone deaf, but he was probably 98% eventually. But it was only, you know, in 1818 that he started having to use conversation books because he just couldn't hear speech anymore. But his performing gradually coasted to a halt in the first decade of the century.
How did he respond to the onset of deafness?
Absolute suicidal despair, and I can't imagine any other reasonable response. He wrote a letter that we call the Heiligenstadt Testament, which is sort of half a suicide note and half a statement of defiance, but he just puts it on the line. He said, I don't think I'm going to have a day of joy in the rest of my life, and that's a terrible thing to think. But he says, finally, I'm going to stay alive for my art. I can't imagine killing myself when I have so much that I can do.
One of the interesting sort of side effects of the deafness is that a lot of his record is written, right? He took a lot of notes, and a lot of his thoughts were put down in writing. I imagine this was a tremendous resource as a biographer.
Yeah, it's unique. Basically, he seemed to hate to throw away any piece of paper that he ever put a pen or a pencil on, so he kept everything. And so we have a certain amount of it got lost because things were ripped up and distributed after he's gone, but there's still hundreds and hundreds of pages of surviving sketches and letters. People were saving his letters from early on because he was famous early on. Yeah, that's where the sort of modern era of sources began. 100 years before that, with Bach, there's just almost nothing because composers were not important, and nobody cared about their sketches and much about their letters. There was a huge change, and it partly had to do with that sense that composers could be immortal now. And he used the word immortal a lot.
Did he write a lot about the process of composition?
No, he didn't like to talk about that. He really didn't much like to talk shop at all. He didn't talk about music that much. And he almost never explained himself. But occasionally something would come out. He'd say, I always want to keep the whole in view, which speaks volumes about his compositional process. His pieces were conceived as a whole. He said at one point, every piece I write has an image or a story behind it, but he very rarely and wisely didn't tell people what those stories were most of the time. But the Third Symphony was a story because it was originally called Bonaparte and ended up being called Eroica.
And tell us the story of that particular symphony.
He, I think, came of age with that piece, and this is a point when everybody, progressives around Europe, thought that Napoleon was going to be the completion of the French Revolution and bring rational governments and better laws around Europe. And he was just the most dynamic person alive. And he was also perceived as somebody who raised himself by his own bootstraps. He actually was minor provincial nobility, but nobody born as obscure as he had ever come to that kind of power. So he was kind of a symbol in himself, and the Third Symphony was absolutely based on him and the heroic ideal and the effect that heroes have or can have on societies. That's the point I felt that Beethoven finally succeeded in attaching his ideals that he grew up with to his music once and for all. And it was a tremendously exciting time for him. And he also wanted to go to France, and he may have wanted to have a symphony that he could hand to Napoleon in person. But when he heard that Napoleon had crowned himself emperor, he immediately said, that means he's a fraud, and he tore up the title page. Which is kind of amazing to me. It shows his integrity. He would expect him to say, well, maybe it's not so bad. I just wrote this piece. he pitched a fit, one of his fits, and just that was it for Napoleon.
There are symphonies, of course, that anyone, even people who don't know a lot about Beethoven, are familiar with, one of them being the Fifth Symphony. Did you learn anything new about that work in doing the research for your book?
There's a certain amount of analysis of the music in the book and how tightly that piece is woven together. He obviously started off saying, I'm going to base a whole piece on this incredibly tiny piece of material. Da-da-da-da. And and it's going to go from beginning to end. You hear that rhythm and ramifications of it all the way to the last page of the symphony. And I think that was kind of radically new. One of my favorite stories about it is that a musician who taught Berlioz went to hear it for the first time, and he said after he came out, he was so upset and excited that when he tried to put his hat on, he couldn't find his head.
The other great work is the Ninth Symphony. What did you discover about that?
I came to feel that the Ninth, and I think this is fairly new to me, was what a lot of people didn't realize, that Set's Ode to Joy, the Schiller poem. Well, that poem was written in the 1780s, the revolutionary decade, and it was sung in the streets by young revolutionaries. It really represented the era of revolution and the kind of enormous hope that by the time this peace was dying was just squashed. Austria was a terrible police state by then. So that piece was designed to keep the idea of hope and freedom alive, I think. But also, to me, the Ninth Symphony, the first movement ends with a funeral march, and the big question is, who died? I think what he's burying in the first movement is the heroic ideal. And in the last movement, he replaces that with a new ideal, which is brotherhood and husbands and wives and love and joy as the source of human happiness. That good societies and happiness are not something brought to us by a hero. They're something we do for ourselves through brotherhood and joy and love.
There are an enormous amount of myths about Beethoven, and you said at the beginning that you sort of wanted to kind of set the record a little bit straight. What are our misconceptions of him as a person and a composer?
Well, part of the myths are just the way he's been put on a pedestal as somebody who's kind of superhuman, and I believe in genius. I say that very clearly, and even though I don't use the word in the book proper. But I don't believe in superhuman demigods. But the other thing, I think, is Beethoven, from his time to this, has had this reputation as a great musical revolutionary. I don't think he was a revolutionary at all. I don't think he intended to be. Revolutionaries are people who want to overthrow the past, and Beethoven based everything he did on the past. He absolutely stayed true to the ideals of Haydn and Mozart and Viennese classical music, even though he took it absolutely in his own direction. So I don't think he never talked about being revolutionary. He was somebody who was a traditionalist in his own unique way. So I ended up calling him a radical evolutionary. He certainly brought new things to music, but he was not trying to overthrow the past.
Is it correct to see in him the epitome of the classical music period and the beginnings of Romanticism? Is that?
Yeah, he's the link between those two things. I think in his head, he was very much a person of the 18th century, especially. Remember, he came of age in the revolutionary 1780s. I think that's sort of where he stayed, but that's who he was, and he believed in reason and order, and he was kind of religiously deistic, but his audience were romantics. He was the composer for romantics. And I think toward the end of his life and his later music, that did have an effect on him, but it's hard to pin down. But I don't think in his head he was ever really romantic, but he was the composer for romantics, and romantic music was absolutely based on him more than anything else.
All right. The book again is Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph by Jan Swofford. Jan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Pamela. It's been great.
Amy Rowland joins me now. She is an editor at The Book Review. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
And you are also the author of a novel, The Transcriptionist, reviewed recently in our pages. Explain the title of the book.
Well, The Transcriptionist is a very literal title. It's about a character who is the last transcriptionist for a New York City newspaper. She takes live recordings and types them up for news reporters.
You wouldn't know anything about this particular job, would you?
I did do some real research for this job. I was a transcriptionist at the Times. That's not what they called us, but that's what we did.
What did they call you?
They called us recording room operators. And we had a little room on the 11th floor of the old building over on 43rd Street. It was a very strange job at a very strange time.
When was this?
I started the job about 2 weeks before September 11th, and I worked there until 2004 when I moved to the Index for another strange job, which
for next novel. Oh,
that's right. I don't think I could, you know, someone else has to write that novel. It's funny because I just learned reading Thomas Berger's obit that he was also a summary writer for the Index. So maybe it's good novelist training.
So what does a transcriptionist or what was the title?
Recording room operator.
A recording room operator do, exactly.
In the early 2000s, it was right before technology totally changed. So we still had television set up with video, you know, VCRs. We would record debates or speeches, political speeches, and we would transcribe those. We would take calls from reporters on the street. Sometimes they could be anywhere. They could be in Manhattan or they could be in Kabul. And they would call us for whatever reason, and we would transcribe the work that they were dictating. And
so they might have done like an interview on the street, and they wanted to make sure to sort of get it in and have it filed to be available for...
Right. It was a real variety. I mean, sometimes Anna Kissel-Goff always called us with her dance reviews because she had repetitive stress, I think, syndrome. We took some calls. You know, sometimes foreign reporters had technological problems and they would call us to dictate. And then sometimes with breaking news, you know, reporters or even stringers would just call in.
And was it a special line dedicated and different people would sort of man the phone at a given time?
Yes, yes. And it was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of hurry up and wait. We would be sitting there. There would be a few of us. We worked in shifts and the phone would ring and we would, you know, run to the recording line and start a tape rolling. And we would listen for a few minutes, and then we would start that tape and leave another tape running. So it was to get it to the desk.
Did you get repetitive stress syndrome?
I did not, but I don't know why.
So what were the most interesting things that, like, what experiences that you had doing this job?
The difficult part of the job was the time, because there was a lot of work related to September 11th and its aftermath. And that was pretty difficult because you could be sitting there typing up a vows column, and then you would get these calls, you know, about a bombing in Iraq. And so you were constantly, you know, you were absorbing the news and also, you know, constantly switching gears because anything at all could come in.
Were you working on 9/11?
I was. That was... like, you know, one of my first days of work, and I was living in a sublet on 112th Street, and I had to walk because, you know, the subways were down. So I got here, and I was the only one here. I didn't really know what I was doing yet, but I just put on a headset and went to work, and eventually one other colleague got in, and we were here until, I think, 3 or 4 in the morning.
Who was calling in? What were you?
People from downtown, you know. They were calling in, and it was such a, you know, chaotic day. You know, we were there to be ready, and the desk wanted us to be ready, and people were calling in from all over Manhattan. And then right in the middle of it, we got, you know, some golf scores from Long Island. So it was just a really strange
surreal
day. Yeah, very surreal.
Did you know, were you writing a novel before you started this job, or did the seeds of it come to you as you were?
Well, I had written a novel before I started this job. And that's why I took the job, because I wasn't sure what to do. I knew the novel didn't work. It was a Southern novel, terrible Southern epistolary novel.
Where did you get that from, Amy Rowland?
Yeah, really. That also came from experience. Although not the plot. It was a very bleak bleak book, and I just couldn't make it work. And so I took this job here, and I was kind of licking my wounds because I thought, what am I going to do? And I never thought about writing a novel about the job until I left. I started eventually, just to kind of make sense of it because it was so surreal, I started sketching things out in my notebook, and I would just take it to the extreme. You know, I would take the absurdity or the extremity, and I would just push it even further. And I got some enjoyment out of that. And then, you know, the character started evolving, and I realized that it was becoming a novel. But that was after I left the job.
It has this kind of ominous tinge, the title, The Transcriptionist. What's the book about?
So The Transcriptionist becomes obsessed with a story about a blind woman who commits suicide in the lion's den of the zoo. That's the plot in a nutshell. And then she starts pursuing this story. She's a bit obsessed with this woman who it turns out she met on a bus just by coincidence. And as she does that, she starts to ask some broader questions about journalism and ethics and truth and objectivity. And she, you know, becomes involved with a few people at the newspaper, and they all have very different jobs and very different feelings about the news and news gathering and the responsibilities of news gathering. So it's ultimately, I guess, a book about a woman at work. I don't think there are a lot of books about that, and I think that's an interesting topic.
And the next one, of course, will be behind the scenes at the book review.
That's right.
All right, Amy Rowland, author of The Transcriptionist, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
It's pretty slim pickings this week. There are just three new titles on the hardcover fiction list. Starting at number 9, J.A. Jantz. That's Judith Ann Jantz, who writes several best-selling mystery series, is back with one of her Sheriff Joanna Brady series about a county sheriff in Arizona called Remains of Innocence. That book is new at number 9. Then at number 4, Danielle Steele is also back on the list with a book called A Perfect Life. This is a novel about a morning anchor for a TV show who is feeling threatened by a beautiful young newcomer she thinks is being groomed to take her place. And it's also very much a mother-daughter story about her blind daughter who has just returned to live with her from a boarding school. And then at number 3, a book that has the clumsy title, Tom Clancy, Support and Defend.
Very odd.
It's not by Tom Clancy, who died last October. It is by Mark Greaney. Mark Greaney was a longtime collaborator with Tom Clancy. He co-wrote several of Clancy's last books with him. Rather, he wrote several
right,
of Tom
right.
Clancy's last books, but they shared credit. So Greaney very much knows what Clancy is all about, and he's continuing, that they call this a novel in the tradition of Tom.
In the school of,
yeah,
as they would say, in the art world.
Greaney was a longtime collaborator, and the star of this novel, Dominic Caruso, is a longtime recurring Tom Clancy character. He's actually the nephew of Jack Ryan, who, of course, was Tom Clancy's big famous breakthrough character. So this is a Dominic Caruso novel, but not written by Tom Clancy.
And on nonfiction?
Nonfiction, there's only one new title this week, actually. It is another Clinton book, the third Clinton book to be on the list right now. It's called Clinton Incorporated, or Clinton, Inc., by Daniel Halper, who is the online editor for the Weekly Standard, the neoconservative magazine, The Weekly Standard. As you might guess from that background, it's a fairly unflattering look at the Clintons, but it is more substantive, apparently more heavily researched and reported than Ed Klein's Blood Feud about the purported conflict between the Obamas and the Clintons, which remains on the list at number 3 this week. The number 1 bestseller this week on the nonfiction side is Dinesh D'Souza's America. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, I wasn't sure why it had taken so long for that book to hit the list when it came out over a month ago. There's also a companion movie called America. I thought they came out at the same time, but in fact, the movie came out about a month later, and that explains why suddenly people are now excited about the movie, and so therefore they're going out and buying the book.
What about the video game?
Coming soon.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.